Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very pleased to have with me today on Research Matters, Mr. Paul Michael Camilleri, who is a senior lecturer at the university's junior college. He first started working at the university as a laboratory officer in biology in 1969, so we're just about coming up to a 40th anniversary. Then he went on to read for a B.Ed. Honours here at the University of Malta, and after a short time as a teacher, he became an assistant lecturer. Mr. Camilleri studied abroad in Wales as well for 2 years, studying biology. He followed short courses in aquaculture at the University of Stirling in Scotland, marine environment in Sweden, DNA technology in Denmark, and he also went to Cyprus where he followed a course in forestry. Mr. Camilleri's main research is in aquaculture, renewable energy, solar and wind, and the subject of today's discussion, seahorses. Welcome to the programme, Mr. Camilleri.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, I know that we have spoken about your research on a previous occasion in a previous series of Research Matters, but I know since the last time we spoke, obviously you've done a lot more work, a lot more research and written more papers, etc. So perhaps you could bring us up to speed on what you've been doing.
Yes, well, the research has been ongoing for 6 years now. I need a lot of work because I have to go to all divers in Malta. I give them a data sheet, which they fill up after diving. On the other hand, during my research, I have written 3 papers on Mediterranean seahorses. And I have been abroad to Portsmouth, where I registered this research for a PhD study. I have been in contact with other universities, and we have signed an agreement, a collaboration agreement with Bologna University. Several universities are involved in this research, because people who are interested in seahorses are far and wide. In actual fact, the main professor, Amanda Vincent, who is involved in seahorse research, lives in Canada in the British Columbia. And the second in command, we can say that, Dr. Keith Martin-Smith, who lives in Tasmania. I am in contact with them all the time through the internet. And besides that, I go once every year to Portsmouth to have a pep talk with my tutor at the Portsmouth University. Besides that, I'm in contact, as I said before, with Bologna University, which helped me a lot to formulate the data sheet. And I'm also in contact with London University, where they had a PhD student studying seahorses and DNA fingerprinting of seahorses in the wild.
And here in the Mediterranean, what is the situation? Because you mentioned Canada and Tasmania. I presume that there's a big difference between the seahorses that you find in the in Australasia and the seahorses you might find off the Canadian coast.
Yes. Look, seahorses usually live in warm waters. They are mainly in the tropics. But they do exist in colder waters. The Mediterranean is considered colder than the tropics. We have two what we call indigenous species that they have always been in the Mediterranean. One is called Hippocampus ramulosus and one is called Hippocampus hippocampus. I must say that all species have a Latin name. It's the scientific name and it is recognized the world over. So when I say hippocampus, hippocampus, I will be referring to a specific seahorse, like when you say a lion. So the individual will know exactly what he is talking about. Besides that, during the last few years, we can call them intrusions. We had one seahorse is coming from the Atlantic, and it has been found near Algiers, and it's called Hippocampus aligarus. And we have another one which has came to the Red Sea, which is called Hippocampus fuscus. Now, these may have come in with the waves, or they may have come in as ballast in tankers. We don't know how. But they are slowly and surely spreading across the Mediterranean. Now, whether they will affect the indigenous species of the Mediterranean, we at this moment do not know. At the moment, I have found from my research that the two indigenous species can live in the same habitat and they do not affect one another, because they are small in numbers. In the tropics, they are large in numbers, in actual fact. In India and in Asian countries, they are used as for medicine, and they are taken for many ailments, and they are caught in, not in hundreds, not in thousands, but in millions. So you must realize that in Southeast Asia, they are found in great numbers. In our seas, they are found in very, very small numbers indeed.
And what is the reason for that? Is that because just the Mediterranean doesn't support large numbers of them, or are they lessening in number?
No. First of all, the Mediterranean is a closed sea. It has been fished since time immemorial. Now, first of all, they are caught as bycatch. So when the fishermen throw their nets in the sea and pull them up, especially when they have piercing nets, when they dredge the sea floor, they make a lot of havoc and they affect the seahorses. And as we know and as we read in the papers, overfishing has occurred in the Mediterranean and on many species. Secondly, as it is a closed sea and we pollute our seas with raw sewage, with crude oil, with construction industry waste, and all these are having an effect on the seabed where the seahorses live, and therefore we are in a way eliminating the seahorse from our own environment. And so they are small in number, but they are becoming less and rarer to find in our seas.
With this research that you're doing, I presume you're going to be able to perhaps put forward some suggestions as to how one might be able to keep those numbers at least at the levels they are today.
Yes, in some bays. I would not like to mention the areas because there is some pilfering. But in some bays where yachts put down their anchor, they dredge the sea bottom, and in so doing, they affect the habitat of seahorses. So ideally, when yachts go in particular bays, they should lay anchor in a particular point, not in various points of the same bay, so as not to have the least effect possible on seahorses' lives.
I know that you've built up over the years of your research a very good relationship with the people who are, in a way, helping you to collect the data. You mentioned the divers before.
Yes.
How do you go about that?
No, I have to go personally to the divers and give them my data sheets. And then when they go diving, they look for seahorses in the wild. I must say that it's very difficult to pinpoint a seahorse because seahorses are well camouflaged against the seagrass and the seaweeds. And then when they come after the dive, they fill in the data sheets, and then I go to collect them. Sometimes I'm in Grozo, sometimes I'm in Comino, sometimes I'm at the far ends of Malta to talk to the divers and to gather the data sheets. Now we are coming to a close. Ideally, this research should continue, not by me, by some other students in the following years. In England, they have what's called the National Trust of Seahorses, and this research in England has been going on for 20 years, but they get a lot of funding from the government to do so. I'm working without funds at the moment, and so it is more difficult for me to do this research.
And where would you normally find a seahorse? They have these beautiful tails, which I know
yes.
they use to hang on to
yes.
algae and things
yes.
like that.
Yes. Well, they are usually in the warm months, from March to November, they are found in shallow waters, where they come in to breed. I must say that we have found four breeding grounds in Malta, and that is a plus. And that means that they are still breeding in our seas. But then, when the seas become rough, they migrate out to sea. and then they come back the next year. So they migrate from shallow to deep and from deep to shallow, and they also migrate vertically upwards and downwards as well during the mating season.
The seahorse is, in fact, a fish.
Yes.
It doesn't look exactly like one when you sort of look at it for the first time, but it is, isn't it?
It's like a mythical creature in a way, because the head looks like a seahorse, like a horse. That's why we call it a seahorse. It is like a chameleon because it changes its colors all the time. It is what we call cryptic. It blends with the environment totally. You can't really see it. And sometimes it not only hangs on to algae or seaweed, but it sways with the algae. So you have to be a very good diver with a very good eye to see the seahorse in situ, that is where it is. And the tail is like a monkey-like because it grabs anything which is close to hold on to it.
And it's got fins?
Yes, it doesn't have all fins. It has the pelvic fins, the pectoral fins, the dorsal fin, and the anal fin. The pelvic fins have been lost through evolution.
And it has some peculiarities as to reproduction, doesn't it?
Yes, well, that is the most important thing, I think. It's the only creature, the only living organism where we have male pregnancy. But I must say that the male produces sperm and the female produces the eggs. But instead of the male putting the sperm into the female, it's the female which puts the eggs into the male. The male has a pouch which he will carry the eggs within him. They develop within, and then when the time comes, he goes into labor and he exudes fully formed seahorses into the water.
And you have had some visitors, haven't you, to the islands, divers,
yes.
Scholars who've come to look at the situation here in Malta?
Yes, I had a PhD student from London University who came here twice to dive in Malta because she is doing DNA fingerprinting of seahorses of the Mediterranean and the North Sea. She has finished her studies now, and last summer we had the head of the National Seahorse Trust of UK coming to Malta.
And what did they find of interest here? What differed from their own situation?
Well, more or less, the research is complementary to one another. We help each other, as it is. Mm-hmm. In England, they have gone further because they have done the breeding process, which I hope to do if I have enough funding, and they have been able to either to sell them to aquaria or to release them back into the wild to help the species to survive.
And that is actually possible to breed them and actually put them back into the natural habitat?
Yes, it is possible, but it is a little bit difficult because seahorses have to eat live bait, we call it, small shrimps that have to pass in front of the seahorse. The seahorse has to notice them and literally suck them up.
Yes, it has that hoover-shaped snout, doesn't it?
The most prominent part of the head is the mouth section, where it is in the form of a snout, because it helps the animal to vacuum up the prey which is passing in front of him.
In fact, you were explaining to me before we came on air the fact that if you were able to breed the seahorses, you'd have to have different aquaria.
Yes, you have to have the different aquaria. They don't eat breadcrumbs, for example. You have to have one aquarium with live bait, small shrimps, microscopic shrimps. So you have to breed those first. Then you have to have another aquarium, and it has to be a different aquarium as well. It has to be at least 2 meters deep to have seahorses, because when they do the ritual dance, they need a vertical height of at least 2 meters. And then you can introduce the live baits to the seahorses, and they feed upon it.
And really, this use of volunteers is absolutely key to your
research. Well, I have gone out of the lab and into the wild, as it is, and I'm being helped by many volunteers in Malta and Gozo. Without them, this research couldn't be done, and I thank them for it.
You mentioned that in the UK they've set up this National Seahorse Trust.
Yes.
What would be necessary here to be able to do something like that here in Malta? What would you need? I mean, give us a wish list of an ideal situation. Yeah.
What they do in England is that they are registered as a charity organization, and they get funds from UK lotteries. And so the research can continue year by year. It is funded on a yearly basis. So the money is coming in, so they can continue working year by year on it, and the research expands year by year. If we can do it over here, it would be ideal.
And you were mentioning that you're also following this up and at a PhD level.
Yes, yes.
What will you have to do now to sort of extend the research?
No, now we are in the phase of translating the data into statistics, and then we turn them into graphical analysis, and I have to write the thesis, and I have started writing the thesis. So in the next 2 years, it will be finished. But as an extension to the project, I intend to start a breeding project in UK, and it will be replicated in Malta if I get EU funds.
You've also mentioned that you had to look into the physical side, not just the habits or the habitat or whatever. Apart from the breeding, the reproduction idea, what is interesting physically about this particular fish?
No, it's very interesting. Because, first of all, it doesn't look like a fish at all. Instead of scales, it has a skin over its skeleton. It swims upright, and all the other fish swim in a horizontal way. And internally, it has no stomach, it has no teeth. It has lost some fins, and it is adapted to a sedentary mode of living. It lives very close to the seabed. The young ones do float in the surface, but they only do that when they are born, so as to disperse the species along the seas, you know.
To obtain the results, you have to use a data sheet.
Yes.
Is it a very detailed data sheet? How is it structured?
Yes, the data sheet is quite detailed. It is easy to follow. They have to put down where they see the seahorses, which species has been seen, at what depth they have seen the seahorses, whether the seahorses have filaments or not, and the color of the seahorses as well, because seahorses change color according to their environment. So we have a lot of parameters to look after, and then we will analyze these data later on, and we will have them graphically formed.
And have you been able to do interim results or results over a number of months?
I have already started analyzing the results. What I have found is that the two seahorses that are in the Mediterranean are both present in Malta. The ones that have been, let us say, imported to the Mediterranean, which I mentioned before, have not been seen in Maltese waters yet. The two seahorses that live in Malta are compatible to one another, that is, they accept one another in the same habitat, and they do not compete between each other. Maybe birds, as they are small in number, the food that they have in the vicinity is enough for both of them.
And you mentioned earlier that there were five universities involved in this particular project. Do they all have a particular competence? How does the cooperation actually work?
Yes. On the internet, you will find what is called the Project Seahorse. It's a worldwide organization, but it is established in Canada. I keep in contact with them all the time. because the main professor, as I said, lives in Canada, and she gives me information and data and what to look for and how to analyze the data as well. In Australia, there is another professor there who gives information, and I keep in touch with them through the internet. I have to been to Bologna, where we formulated the data sheet, so they are interested in seahorses around Malta, because they were deeply interested about seahorses around Italy. And from London University, as I said before, a student who has now graduated, and she is a PhD doctor now, and she was studying fingerprinting of seahorses in the Mediterranean up to the North Sea. And then there is the University of Malta, and I represent the university.
And I can imagine hearing you talk about divers and boating and yachts, and that somehow this is one of those cases where you have a scientific investigation which is also neatly placed to in the discourse of tourism and travel. And how do you think one might be able to place this scientific research in that context?
First of all, the scientific research is of an environmental one. It also has implications as regards biodiversity. Biodiversity means which animals or which plants or which organisms live in our surroundings. I must say that the research like this has never been done before. We are looking for seahorses up to 100 meters offshore. We need a lot of data coming from different directions. Besides that, the diving industry, if we have seahorses in Sea Malta, they attract divers to Malta. I must say that during the summer months, usually I have about 500 divers diving in Malta Sea. So it is a plus again. If we have seahorses now in our environment, they attract tourists, they attract divers who come here to look for seahorses in our blue sea.
So they have a vested interest, in making sure that they sort of help you out with your research.
Many diving communities see that this type of research is helping them as well in their own industry. So we have academia and industry helping one another. They help me with the data. I help them, hopefully, with my statistical data, and hopefully we'll have a breeding process in the future.
In fact, it is a very attractive physical being, the seahorse, which I suppose, in a way, looking at it from the outside, is helps to be able to put across the idea that this is, you know, an interesting piece. Okay, it's a piece of scientific research, but the fact that they're a very popular kind of image, aren't they?
In a way, they are mythical, because even many people do not know that a seahorse is a fish.
In fact, it's often a question on the Millionario program Jerry Scotti.
The fact is that that the seahorse is a fish. There are 40 species now all around the world. When I say a species, like you have a tiger and a lion, they are all seahorses, but they are different to each other. They entice people to have a look at them, you know, and they have an attractive force to humans. I don't know why, but when somebody comes to Malta, a diver comes to Malta, the first thing that he says to the diving community, "Where can I see a seahorse?" So
but you're not letting on exactly where you can see the seahorses.
No, unfortunately. Although I have found about 30 places where seahorses have been found in Malta, and I have found also 4 places where they breed, I am not giving the locations, because I have been informed that there have been some pilfering of seahorses from overseas. Mm-hmm. And that is, I must say, that is illegal, because seahorses are endangered species and they are protected by law.
Yes, because from what you were saying, they can reach quite high. You can get quite high prices for them.
Yes, 100 euros each, or more sometimes. It depends upon the rarity of the species.
Well, I can imagine also that young people can be sort of get interested in this particular animal, this particular fish. Perhaps is there any effort to put across the idea of this project in schools? Because I would imagine that it would be an attractive idea.
Up to now, I did not have the time to go that way. Let's put it this way. I have been engrossed with work at a higher level. I think it also entices school children, and I think the fact is, if the presence of seahorses in our sea is a plus, as I said, and it's even by children it's considered a mythical creature, and if it is in our seas, and if eventually these youngsters become divers themselves, they can see seahorses in the wild.
Exactly, I think it's very important that. For something like this, the educational side of it,
yes,
is very important.
We must teach everybody to respect nature, whatever it is. Whatever the organism is, we have to respect it. And seahorses have to be respected, as I said, for more reasons than one.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mr. Camilleri, for coming to Research Matters to talk about seahorses. It's certainly a beautiful creature, and this was a very, very, very interesting piece of research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.